The 1st of November, 1959. Over 40,000 people hear the final whistle at Dalymount Park. Sweden are in town to play against the Republic of Ireland. The year before, Sweden were runners-up in the World Cup final, losing 5-2 to a talent-packed Brazil side that had Pelé and Garrincha in it. Ireland had dropped to an ominous-looking 2 goals down after just 12 minutes, but the ship was steadied. Ireland reply with 2 goals of their own, and incredibly, the spectators have seen 4 goals in just the first 25 minutes of the game. Dermot Curtis scores his 2nd goal of the match in the 53rd minute. And 3-2, that's how it would stay. A courageous win for the home team. World Cup finalists defeated. Oh, and the scorer of the 1st goal for Ireland? Well, that was a young 19-year-old who was making his debut for his country. Little did the young lad from Ormond Square in Dublin know that he was at the beginnings of his own journey into Irish footballing immortality. Johnny Giles had arrived. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, along with the football knowledge master that is Gary Spain. Coming up on this week's show, we're focusing on the Irish national team from the late 50s through to the late 60s and early 70s as they play in front of over 100,000 people in Poland. A memorable, or maybe not so memorable, 1-0 win against West Germany in Germany, and we get introduced to a young man who would leave a huge impact on Irish football, Johnny Giles. We'll have great interviews coming up in the next few weeks as well as I sit down with the great Pat Finlan and former Republic of Ireland manager Owen Hand. So make sure you're subscribed to the show so you don't miss out on those. You can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on, whether Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music or YouTube Podcast and more. You can find us there. Share the show on your social media as well and help to spread the word about the podcast. Okay, intro's done. Let's get on with the show. So, Gary, I suppose if we kind of talk about what we're going to be doing this week on the show, the last time we were together, we kind of did the League of Ireland up until probably the late 60s, but we didn't really touch on any of the national team stuff. So I think we're going to go a little bit backwards again and start from the late 50s to talk about the international scene and the Irish national team from there. I suppose there's a lot of kind of significant things that happen in that period. So I suppose, why don't you kind of give us a little insight as to what happens, I suppose, from the late 50s on through to the kind of the decade of the 60s?
Yeah, so we kind of left it with John Attio breaking Irish hearts in 1957 at Dalymount Park. And obviously we missed out on the World Cup in 58 in Sweden, which of course had the, well, it was a very famous World Cup. It was the introduction of Pelé. It was Brazil winning the World Cup, etc. 1958, just one that's kind of forgotten. We played in a friendly in Poland, I think in Katowice, and there were 100,000 people turned up to watch the Irish team draw 2-2 with Poland. Incredible crowd, and probably the biggest crowd we ever played in front of. That was just an aside, really. It was just one of many friendlies in Poland. I'm certainly not going to talk about all of those. But if we move on to 1959...
Without trying to cut across you too quickly, but do we know why the crowd was so big? Did they just love football, so 100,000 people turned up?
Yeah, I think, well, the stadium was one of these massive bowls, and I think there probably wasn't a lot to do in communist Poland in 1958. So probably the novelty of the game there. The one thing I will say, and it has been said about our tours of Poland, and Ray Tracy, I suppose the late Ray Tracy, was well able to talk about them. But the FAI were always willing to go anywhere in Poland. And if you look at where we played, I think that might be the reason we were so popular there, that we went to places like Wrocław, Poznan, Bydgoszcz, Łódź, Katowice, probably Krakow. I'm probably forgetting one or two as well. So we went all over. So we were probably very welcome visitors there, when I suppose many countries probably wouldn't want to have gone too far outside of Warsaw.
And that's so interesting. Was it just, I suppose, the background specter of communism, and there was kind of like some sort of solidarity that was going on there between the two countries or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, some of it might be. I don't really know. I mean, there was obviously a very good relationship between the two FAs. Even though Poland was obviously a very communist country, was also maybe a very Catholic country, and there might have been something. And I mean, even to this day, there's very good relations between the Irish and the Poles. And but so I don't really know why we played them so often. I mean, they came to Dublin quite a bit as well. And I mean, these games date back to the 30s, but particularly the late 50s, 60s, into the 70s. We played them on many occasions. I think Paddy Bonner's debut was in Poland in 81 in Bydgoszcz.
Wow.
I'm sure some other. I think Ray Tracy famously said he got 40 odd caps for Ireland, and half of them were against Poland. It's not. I don't think it's strictly true, but it mightn't be that far off, you know. So
the assumption of playing so much against Poland, was it?
Yeah.
So sorry, I interrupted you. So you're moving on to what, 58?
When I move on to 1959, and a couple of significant, I'll mention another significant debut. I talked about Paddy Bonner. The 1958 World Cup, Brazil, famously Pelé's Brazil, beat Sweden in the final. That Swedish team came to Dublin a year later, and they took a 2-0 lead after about 12 minutes. And we came back, and it was Dermot Curtis got two goals, but the opening Irish goal was scored by a young fella in midfield making his debut, who scored a rasping shot, and it was Johnny Giles. What became one of the greats, one of the all-time greats, arguably our greatest ever player. And of course, later to become player manager and everything as well. So that was a significant win. I think, if I remember correctly, I think Sweden came to Wembley and either won or drew. I might be proven wrong on that, but at the same time. But certainly beating Sweden 3-2 in Dublin was significant. And another one, and this, when I hear it as a quiz question, I always wince because it's wrong. Right, but
okay,
there
here
is
we
a
go.
Quiz
You're
question.
Gonna set it all straight now.
So, I've got to set it all straight. So the way the quiz question is asked is, which two nations met in the first ever game in the European Championship? And the reason we are the wrong answer to it is we played Czechoslovakia, who of course no longer exist, in the preliminary round. So the two of us were drawn to meet in the preliminary round. It was a knockout. It was a straight knockout at the time. And there was one extra team in UEFA. So I think it probably would have been, 33 teams in UEFA at the time that entered. So we were drawn against Czechoslovakia in the preliminary round. But the reason the quiz question is wrong is, if you look at the way the fixtures are set up, they'll show the preliminary round first. But we didn't actually play the Czechs until April 1959. And the Soviet Union played Hungary in the first ever game in the European Championships way back in September 1958. So if you hear the answer giving as the Republic of Ireland or Czechoslovakia, it's actually incorrect. Still a significant...
There was no kind of league qualification. It was you faced off against whoever you were drawn with, and winner kind of went through to the next round.
Winner went on, exactly, yeah. So we drew Czechoslovakia. We beat them 2-0 in Dublin. Great win. Liam Toohey with a famous goal. But unfortunately, a few weeks later, we went to Bratislava and were beaten 4-0. So the Czechs progressed on aggregate to go through. So also, the European I mentioned the USSR were the first team to play. They knocked out Hungary, obviously a very talented Hungarian side in the 50s. They went on to win that tournament. The finals were held in France, but only the last four actually got to the finals in those days. So the finals were a four-team tournament. And I will go on to talk about the next tournament in a few minutes, but which is a bit more significant from our perspective. But it was a very good win over the Czechs in the first game, but of course we were beaten 4-0 in the return. And I'm only picking out games at this point, but we played Wales for the first time in 1960. they came to Dublin and beat us, actually. But a significant win in 1960. We went to Dusseldorf and beat West Germany. And I mean, anytime you beat the Germans, it's a significant result and a 1-0 win. And I mean, the goal scorer, Fionnán Fagan, is probably one of the forgotten men of Irish football. He scored a few goals for us, got a few caps in the late 50s, early 60s. But his winner in Dusseldorf somehow hasn't made it into the annals of Irish footballing history. And it's probably one that should be remembered because anytime you go to Germany and beat the Germans in their own backyard, it's quite an achievement. That would have been the first time we beat them there as well. Not the last, incidentally, but it was the first.
Was that the beginning of West Germany's kind of rise to what we would know becoming a powerhouse of world football that went through the 70s and the 80s?
They had done well in the 58 World Cup, done reasonably well. They'd won, they were the holders, they won the cup in 1954, but I think it's fair to say that was definitely a shock win. They were not expected to win. German football was just recovering. The Bundesliga hadn't even started at this stage. I think that started in 1963, so it was still in regional leagues. But still, to beat Germany was quite a significant achievement in 1960. I suppose it's when you go on, they obviously famously got to the World Cup final in 1966. 1970 got to the semi-final. Yeah. And they went on. I mean, the epic quarterfinal when they beat England in 1970 and an epic semi-final against the Italians. They won the Euros in 1972. They famously won the World Cup in 1974 against the fantastic Dutch side. And, of course, lost the Euros in 76. You could keep going on. I mean, Germany, it's not that often they don't compete. I mean, they are obviously one of the major powerhouses in world football. So I think to go to Dusseldorf and beat them 1-0 was a significant achievement. And you move on then to qualification for the 62 World Cup. And I mean, the results I've just talked about, you'd say we're in with maybe a good shout now of qualifying. Now, we got a tough draw. We got Czechoslovakia, very talented Czech side, and we got Scotland. I mentioned on one of the previous shows, we had maybe 200 fans went to Goodison Park in 1949, and we quite a few fans went to Wembley in 57. Well, I know for Scotland, because one of the fans, I want to give his full name, but he's still in the Aviva and I still see him on a regular basis. But there was a chartered ship that sailed from Dublin to Glasgow for that game.
Wow.
And as Joe said, they were sailing in the Clyde. They went all the way in the Clyde. They were passing all the shipyards, and the boat was full of Irish fans decked out in green and white and singing. And unfortunately, that campaign didn't go too well. We were beaten in all four matches. The Scots, first time we ever played the Scots, they beat us home and away. And the Czechs also beat us home and away. And the Czechs actually beat the Scots after a playoff to qualify for that World Cup. And I talked about the great Brazil team in 58. They won the World Cup again, of course, in 1962. Mm-hmm. But that was actually not Pele. Pele was injured. It was Garrincha. The player, Mané Garrincha, who's in Brazil, he is considered on the same level as Pele. If you visit the Brazil National Museum, there are two busts when you go in. One is Pele and one is Garrincha. But when you kind of go out of Brazil, it's mainly Pelé people are talked about. But Garrincha was an absolutely wonderful, wonderful player. He made quite an impact in Sweden as well. But 62 was his World Cup, and Brazil beat Czechoslovakia, the Czech side that had beaten us home and away. So Brazil beat them in the final to win the World Cup. So it was always going to be difficult for us to qualify for 62, given who we were up against. And
but showed though that we lost to quality opposition. I mean, if you're playing a team that's that knocks you out, but they get to a World Cup final. You got to kind of weigh that up as the equation, really.
Yeah, you do. But I mean, I don't think I can make a case for any hard luck stories or anything like that. We were well beaten in those days by a better side. But we move on then to and another quiz question that kind of people forget. Well, I suppose these days there are actually four times when the Republic of Ireland played in the last eight of a major football tournament, and people with top straight away, Italia 90, right? The obvious one. And then you think, well, Euro 88, it was only eight teams, so we qualified, we reached the last eight. And we talked about the 24 Olympics when we got to the quarterfinal against the Dutch. And but definitely the forgotten one is the 1964 European, well, as it was then, the European Nations Cup, the European Championship as we know it now. And again, we go back and we talk about knockout games. We drew Iceland in the first round and we beat them comfortably. I think it was we put four past them in Dublin, drew away. And then we came up against, in the last 16, we come up against Austria. And in 1963, that was probably going to be the end of the road. The Austrians were a crack team, had done, they regularly were appearing in World Cups. They would have been hot favourites. And we went to Vienna in the first leg and somehow pulled off a 0-0 draw. Now, by all accounts, it was backs to the wall. And I don't know how we survived. The reports are saying basically Austria absolutely dominated us. And it was backs to the wall, but somehow we came away with a 0-0 draw. And then, of course, that sets up in September 1963, a game in Dalymount Park and the famous Dalymount Roar. With a chance to qualify for the last eight. And it was a pulsating, very controversial game. It was 2-2 going into the 89th minute, into the last minute. Noel Cantwell had scored for us in the first half and an own goal had put us ahead, but the Austrians had equalised. And in the 89th minute, the referee awarded a penalty to Ireland. And the crowd invaded the pitch. They eventually got them off the pitch, but there was a bit of a menacing crowd, we'll put it that way, off the pitch, but just behind the white lines, and the Austrians weren't too happy. But it certainly didn't put Noel Cantwell off, because he blasted a penalty to the net, and a very famous win. We beat the Austrians 3-2 and qualified for the last eight of the European Championships. But of course, as I said, only four got to the finals. And then another one that's absolutely forgotten. And because we actually, there was the tantalizing proposition for, I think, a week to 10 days of a Republic of Ireland v Northern Ireland game to qualify for the finals. And I remember back in 1963, we'd never met at this stage. We actually did meet at youth level to qualify for the youths that year, which Northern Ireland actually beat us. I think Pat Jennings and all played in that, in the youths one. But Northern Ireland had drawn 1-1 in Bilbao with Spain in 1963. The return leg hadn't been played in Belfast, and the draw was made for the last eight. And we were drawn against the winners of Northern Ireland and Spain. And with Northern Ireland at home to Spain, it was certainly a realistic shout that it could have been a north-south game. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be. And Spain came to Belfast and won 1-0 to set up the quarterfinal against us. And the dream died in 64. We were well beaten in Seville. We were beaten at home as well. And but it was a very talented Spanish side that actually went on to win the tournament as well.
So why do we not, and I wonder, is it just because of the advent of television and it helps to generate those probably more concrete memories and stuff like that? Why do we not hold it, that and, you know, 1924 on the same kind of pedestal as Euro 88, 1990? Is it simply because the memories perhaps are more ingrained with us now, and we don't have that kind of thing to look back on with the other ones?
Yeah, I think it's because it wasn't considered the major finals. I think that is a big thing, that, you know, you had to get to the last four at that stage. And I suppose because there wasn't television, but back in the day, that Noel Cantwell win, I mean, that's one I remember people talking about, that win over Austria. That was a huge win for Irish football. That was a great day. And it's one my dad will talk about. It's one people who were there. And I suppose, I mean, it's whatever, 60, get my maths bad, but 62 years ago now. And so, I mean, anyone that can remember it is probably well into their 70s or in their 80s in my dad's case. And so, I mean, the memories start to fade and people start to talk about it. But there was a huge crowd in Tailymount Park, and it was a huge day. It was a great win for Irish football, and to beat a crack Austrian side and to knock them out was certainly very impressive. And Spain did prove to be a bridge too far. They put five past us in Seville, but that was only the start of Spain, of course, you know.
Yeah, but again, we're knocked out by the eventual, the winners, so they go all the way in the tournament. So it's again, it's that equation of, okay, we got knocked out, but we got knocked out by the winners. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And of course, then the next World Cup, the 1966 World Cup, we were drawn in a group with Spain and Syria. And Syria actually withdrew. So it became a straight shootout between Ireland and Spain. And we did get some modicum of revenge for the European Nations Cup defeats, because in Dublin, we beat them 1-0. And famously, Iribar, the Spanish goalie, punched the ball into his own net. I think it was under pressure from Noel Cantwell again. And Noel Cantwell, quite a player. What a player. I mean, the Cork man in defence or in attack was certainly one of the stars of Irish football in the 60s. So that set up, there wasn't actually an aggregate score for the World Cup. So that set up us going to Seville again and needing a draw to qualify for the World Cup. And it was also, there was actually a charter flight. I was only talking to one of the fans that was there recently, and he said he reckons it's the first ever case of an Irish fan being arrested abroad at an international football match. And, but it was quite innocent.
Am I allowed to ask the reason why?
Oh, you can, absolutely. It's so one of the, so we were away to Spain, and Martin from Limerick was, well, he wasn't the one arrested. But he was on the trip. I think it was either Drumcondra or Shelburne. It was one of the Dublin clubs ran the trip. And they, both of them ran away trips in those days. So he's on the trip with a lot of people from Dublin. He said they were incredibly well treated in Seville. They were high up in the stadium, and the Spanish were sharing wine with them and everything. They were having a great time. And one of the stars of that Irish team was Frank O'Neill, and who was known as Franco. And one of the Irish fans says, come on. Well, exactly. So he said, come on, Franco. And of course, two Guardia Civil, I think they're called, arrived and arrested him straight away for insulting the Generalissimo, who of course was General Franco of the very, very right-wing Spanish government that was in power at the time. And there was a huge language barrier, and they took this Dublin fan away, and he missed quite a chunk of the match, until eventually it got explained that he was actually just trying to egg on Frank O'Neill instead of trying to insult General Franco, who was certainly, you wouldn't want to have been insulting him in the 1960s or 70s.
Certainly would not have been. Wouldn't have ended well.
So, and on the pitch, I think it's the only men's competitive goal. I could have to be corrected on this, but I think Andy McAvoy scored the only goal that we've ever scored competitively. But the men, obviously Olivia Toole got the wonderful winner in Lucena for the women. But Andy McAvoy equalised and had a perfectly good goal, or so it was called, chalked off to put us ahead in Seville. So maybe the start of these controversial disallowed goals as well. But it wasn't to be, and Spain ran out 4-1 winners in the second half. But that didn't mean they qualified for the World Cup, because the aggregate scores didn't count. And we were both level in the group, and it needed a playoff match to decide who went to the World Cup. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this is one of the black days of Irish football, because there's a lot of rumours and stuff circulating about the game. But because the World Cup was meant to be in England, initially they were talking that the playoff would be in London. I know Highbury was mentioned, Amsterdam was mentioned, and the Spanish actually proposed to the FAI that if they'd agree to play in Paris, which had a big expat Spanish community, that the FAI could keep the gate receipts. And unfortunately, instead of playing in London in front of 40,000 Irish, because obviously in 1960s there were so many Irish people in London, not to mind how many would have travelled over, the game was played in the Parc de France and in front of 30,000 screaming Spanish. And I think 13 Irish fans made the trip to Paris. And it was a very close game. And with 11 minutes to go, I think it was Ufarte got the only goal to send Spain to the 66 World Cup, and that's how close we came. And I know it's a big bugbear with Johnny Giles, with Eamon Dunphy. Eamon Dunphy played that night as well. And unfortunately, there is proof of it. I know Paul Lennon wrote the story in The Star. There's actually proof that that's actually true, because the letter is in the FAI archives in UCD, saying the Spanish saying, here, as promised, here's our share of the gate receipts from Parc de France. But it was the Spanish who went to the 66 World Cup. And, well, who knows what might have happened had we gone there.
Could have knocked England out. It could have been all very different.
Who knows?
Well, you mentioned two names there that are obviously, in fact, three that are hugely popular names in Ireland, in particular with Johnny Giles and Eamon Dunphy. Eamon Dunphy had only just made his debut just before that. Am I right in saying that?
Yes. In and around 65 would have been his debut. I think he was still at York City at the time. That even might have been his debut. I'm not sure. I can't say for sure. But certainly he would have been capped, I think, for the first time in around 1965.
And he's obviously a big kind of, I suppose, probably made his name more of as a pundit than a football player. But in terms of him and his skill, he's one of the things I always noticed about Eamon, when he always compared himself to obviously Johnny Giles and Liam Brady as well, who was always on the panel with him. He was always self-deprecating about his own talents by comparison. So, I mean, was it a fair estimation that he was good but not up there?
He was never
in
the class. I think he would be telling the truth when he said that, because he would never have been. Johnny Giles and Liam Brady were two of the greatest players ever to pull on a green shirt. Now, don't get me wrong, Eamon Dunphy, he was a stylish midfield player. I saw him play with Shamrock Rovers in the late 70s when he came back under Giles. He was a good passer of the ball. Maybe he wouldn't put it about as much as Johnny Giles was certainly well able to put it about as well as
well,
pass
Johnny
the ball.
Giles played in the lead side that their name of the game was to put yourself about.
Yeah, and you mean you talk about that lead side with Norman Hunter, Billy Bremner, Paul Reaney, Paul Madeley, and Johnny was just as well able to mix it with the rest of them.
Picking people into the stands.
But Eamon Dunphy was a stylish footballer. Look, he was good enough to play for his country, and he played for many years into the early 70s, but he would have been a limited enough player in England. I mean, he was playing, a lot of his footballing career was in the lower leagues. So he did come to fame. Well, his book actually on a season at Millwall is an incredible read.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Only a Game, question mark. But that was from a season in the 70s. So obviously became very controversial on the TV after that as well. But certainly in football terms, not fit to be discussed in the same story as Johnny Giles or Liam Brady, but very few players are. I mean, if you're picking an all-time Irish 11, I mean, you're talking Giles, Brady. Well, yeah, they have to be, you know, two of the all-time greats, you know.
Talk to us a little bit about, and I know we will move on with other kind of Ireland games and stuff like that, but for somebody like you, who would have seen a lot of Ireland games, etc. Talk to us a little bit about, I suppose, first of all, Johnny Giles and his ability and his skill. He played with an incredible lead side as well. Talk to us a little bit about him and his abilities, because, as you say, arguably one of the greatest players we've ever produced.
Yeah, so I was fortunate to see him play. So my first men's game was 75 against Switzerland. And of course, Johnny was player manager. So he was still playing right up to the late 70s. And he was just a brilliant midfield player, and he had everything. So he could tackle, he could pass, he could shoot, he could control a game. And just one of the all-time greats. I mean, he actually started off at Manchester United and went to they won the cup in 63, but for some reason they sold him to Leeds United. And of course, wow, he's synonymous with that great Leeds team of the late 60s and early 70s that should have won so many more trophies. I mean, they were runners-up so many times. They missed out on league titles, FA Cups. The 75 European Cup final haunts Leeds fans to this day. There's so many things, so many what might have beens, what if onlys. They lost the 73 FA Cup final to Sunderland in one of the greatest shocks of all time. In 1970, they were so close to winning a treble, and they ended up losing the league because there's so many games built up. They lost the European Cup semi-final to a great Celtic team and lost the FA Cup final after a replay to Chelsea and ended up with nothing. And that was probably the story of that great Leeds team, that they did win a couple of league titles. They won an FA Cup in 72. They won a Fairs Cup and they won a League Cup as well. And sorry, apologies, Leeds fans, I might have missed something out of that. But for a team that was so dominant for about a decade, they really should have won far more trophies.
But he was an integral part of that. I mean, like, I know we talk about them as, you know, the nearly bins and all of those kind of things, but this was a phenomenal lead side, probably arguably one of the greatest lead side of all time, who were just so
One of the greatest English top flight sides of all time. They have to be up there in, I mean, you're talking about Leeds from about 66, 67 up to about 75. The Liverpool team that came after that, obviously Man United under Alex Ferguson, Pep's Man City, Jose Mourinho's Chelsea. You can go back, Herbert Chapman's Arsenal, Herbert Chapman's Huddersfield. I mean, you can go back to the Preston Invincibles in the 1880s, but I mean, that Leeds team has got to be up there in the argument, and probably the argument against them would be they didn't win as much as they should have. But they were the team from the late 60s on into the 70s. And even though they won a Fairs Cup, they could have won that European Cup in 1970. I mean, Celtic beat them, and it was a great Celtic team, and Celtic were beaten by Feyenoord then in the final in Milan. I mean, Leeds, I'm sure, will be saying if they didn't have to play so many games at the same time in so many competitions, that they could have won everything that year.
And Johnny Giles was part of that as well.
And he was a key part. I mean, you're talking about that Leeds team. I mentioned Well, I mentioned some of the hard men, and of course, our own Jack Charlton was part of that team as well. You got the likes of Peter Lorimore. If they had a weakness, it was possibly in goal, whether that was Gary Sprake or later David Harvey. But still, I mean, top quality players, and Mick Jones up front, Alan Clark. I mean, the names still trip off the tongue all 50-odd years, more than 50 years later. And Johnny was an integral part of that team, one of the key members of that team, the engine room of that team in midfield with Billy Bremner beside him.
And we had, am I right in saying that we had Liam Brady then around about the same time, or did he come afterwards?
So Liam made his debut in 1974. So I don't want to jump ahead too much. Yeah, but yeah. So Liam,
they're kind of two slightly
Halcyon days.
Yeah.
So they would have played together. I mean, they played together in that famous win over the Soviet Union, maybe cover in a future podcast. But so Liam's Halcyon days would have gone from about 74 right up to the late 1980s, you know, and maybe unfortunately with injury and suspension missed out on going to a major finals with us. He just was finishing up as the Jack Charlton era was starting off. Yeah.
You mentioned somebody else as well in there too, and I want to talk to you about him as well, which was Noel Cantwell. And him being an integral part of Ireland teams as well. Talk to us a little bit about him, because probably, you know, Johnny's a household name. We all know Johnny Giles, we've seen him on televisions for, you know, 30 odd years, etc., and his playing career, etc. But perhaps we don't know that much about Noel Cantwell, and in your opinion, a really great player in himself. So talk to us a little bit about him. Who was he, and what was his kind of
so
player like?
Noel was a Cork man, son of Cork, still revered in Cork. Arguably, and I know we've got Roy Keane, but he's in the argument for the greatest Cork player. I think we would have to give it to Roy Keane, and certainly I wouldn't be anywhere near Roy Keane. But Noel Cantwell was definitely one of the greats with Manchester United and with West Ham. He, from the late 50s into the 60s, he was one of the greats in that Irish team, and playing defence, playing attack, and a real powerhouse, and one of the heroes of Irish football back in the day. So he would have played with Johnny Giles, obviously too soon to have played with someone like Liam Brady, but in his day, one of the superstars and one of the heroes of Irish football.
Yeah, he won an FA Cup as well with Manchester United in 63, I think.
That would be right, and that was the one Johnny Giles was involved in as well, you know. So
yeah, and it's interesting that I suppose for somebody of his pedigree as well, who held his own in a West Ham side, a very good Manchester United side as well, that perhaps he doesn't get maybe revered as much as Johnny. I know Johnny's an excellent player, but you know, Noel was seemingly a very good player in his own right too.
Yeah, I think the fact that Johnny survived into the TV era, and I mean, Johnny played for 20 years for Ireland and became player manager and everything as well. So I think maybe that's why that Johnny was that little bit younger and he played on that bit longer is why we remember the likes of Johnny Giles, because, I mean, obviously, you were getting massive crowds in Dalymount Park in those days, but otherwise people had to read about it in the newspapers and travelling over to Old Trafford or Anfield. It was done in those days. I mean, I know my dad said, I mean, he did a trip from Limerick that they got games on Good Friday, Easter Saturday and Easter Monday. I think it was 1964. I think they got to see Everton, Liverpool and Manchester United all at home in the same weekend.
What a trip.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, you could just pay at the gate in those days as well. So there would have been trips over, but they would have, relatively speaking, have cost quite a bit of money. But I mean, that would have been, he probably would have seen George Best. I'd have to check the fixtures and whether he would have played. But he certainly had made his debut at that stage with Manchester United, and So there was the opportunity to go to games, and especially as it went into the 60s, people had a bit more money in their pocket, come out of the 50s. But, I mean, the trips to Dublin from Limerick for an international, you couldn't go to every game. You could maybe pick the big games. Obviously, if you were living in Dublin, you could get to most of the games. And we did get very good crowds for the bigger games. And Dalymount Park was absolutely packed for that Austria game. As I said, it was packed for the England game. Scotland game in 61 would have been huge. The win over Spain. I mean, the Dalymount roar was instrumental in some of those famous wins, like Austria 63, Spain 65. It certainly, it encouraged the Irish team so much, and it probably put the frighteners on some of the foreign players as well, who certainly might have felt a little bit intimidated.
What exactly is the Dalymount roar? Are you going to give us an example?
I couldn't even try, but it was certainly very famous, and the late great Philip Green was probably the one who coined, or one of the most famous person I can remember talking about it. But certainly you can hear the vocal backing the Irish team got in those days was something special. And ironically, I mean, I did get to games in Dalymount in the 80s, but the 75 Switzerland game was moved to Lansdowne Road. Now, we did move to Lansdowne 71, but we were back in Dalymount in 72, 74, 73. It was really the bigger games. And I suppose I was 8 years old in 1975. My dad wouldn't bring me. He brought me to Dalymount for Limerick games and for cup finals, semi-finals. But for an Irish game, the crowd would have considered being too big, and maybe it wasn't so easy to get a stand seat, that he wasn't going to bring a 7 or 8 year old boy to stand on the terraces in those days. And I wouldn't have seen anything in those days. But Lansdowne Road, it had lots of seats in those days. But it was a financial risk for the FAI. But it was also a concern that the atmosphere wasn't the same. So there was a feeling that moving to Lansdowne Road in 71 was actually diluting the famous Dalymount atmosphere, that it maybe didn't travel across the river.
That's interesting, because I'm an 80s, 90s child, so I only know the Lansdowne Road and its incredible atmosphere and all those wonderful, incredible moments that we had down there through the years when I was growing up. So explain to us, first of all, what was the financial risk in moving it to the Lansdowne Road, and maybe what was the difference between Dalymount and Lansdowne Road from that point of view? Because I know obviously we played for a very long time with Dalymount, but then there was this kind of switch over to Lansdowne. What happened?
Now, I should find, we did play one game in Lansdowne at 27 against Italy, but up until 1971, all our other home games had been in Dalymount Park. So Dalymount Park in those days had one stand, which was a single decker, and it held a few thousand people, and stand seats for internationals were normally incredibly difficult to get. It had a reserved terrace where you could stand in front of the stand, which wouldn't be, let's say, as crowded. And then you had the two ends and the big, huge open terrace, which I stood on many a day on the far side. It's all changed now, but I mean, for that England game, you would probably have packed in almost 50,000 people, and only a couple of thousand of them would have seats. Maybe a couple of thousand more were in the reserve terrace. And everybody else was packed in either in the school end on the left-hand side as you look out from the current Geordie stand, or the tramway end, which is on your right-hand side, or the big open terrace on the far side. And you couldn't move. Now, I was stood there on the 80s. I was there for a few European games. I saw friendly matches and all that. You had more room. They certainly restricted the crowd a bit more in the 80s. But I know my dad talking about the 57 England game. He was there, but he saw very little of it.
I was about to say, the restricting games, they let 50,000 odd into Dalymount Park.
It was just mobbed. And I mean, back in those days, I mean, they weren't, well, often the gate was broken down as well, but they weren't turning anyone away. There was no question of actually turning anybody away. And so obviously Dannemora Park was in football. It's owned by Bohemians Football Club. And so the rent for the FEI would have been significantly less than Lansdowne Road, which had two double-decker stands, if I remember correctly, in those days. I might be slightly out. I'm not trying to remember if the old East Stand had seats up and down. I think it had. But so in the 70s, I think half the stadium, it still held about 50,000, but daily would have been greatly reduced in the 70s. But a lot of them were seats, so you could charge more for it.
Okay, yeah.
So
yeah.
I must go back to 1968, Waterford drew Manchester United in the European Cup, and they made the decision to play the game in Lansdowne Road,
right, yeah, yeah,
which was considered a huge financial risk.
Yeah, we talked about that in the last podcast, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the FEI, it took the FEI 3 years, initially 71, before moving to Dalymount, moving to Lansdowne. And even then, I think, if I remember, the Austria game was back in Dalymount. France might have been in Dalymount. Soviet Union in 74, that famous win was in Dalymount as well. As I said, Switzerland 75 was my first home game. That was in Lansdowne. France 77 in Lansdowne. But there were still friendlies against Poland 77. I'm pretty sure that was in Dalymount. So we still played in Dalymount right up to 1990, actually. If I remember correctly, Morocco in 1990 would have been the last international in Dalymount. And we played France there actually in 1989, and I remember the French manager described Dalymount as being a stadium from another era or another age.
So, was that his polite way of saying this stadium has character?
Yeah. And it still does. I mean, it's still the home of Irish football, and it's changed obviously significantly beyond all recognition. But certainly there is. It's still a magical place. It's still the home of Irish football.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
Another thing about Dalymount was the pitch wasn't exactly the greatest either, which might have been a bit of a help. As well.
I have an argument that it's still not the greatest in the world either. There's that hill at one of the goalkeeper ends, and it's just, you can see it goes about 6 inches from the box to the center of the goal, and it always annoys me that there's like this professional League of Ireland club that just can't have a flat penalty box. So talk to us a little bit about, we kind of digressed there, sorry for a little bit, but that was really interesting. But if we kind of move back to, I suppose, the mid-1960s with the national team, I suppose, where are we and what does it look like? And I think there's kind of like a little bit of history in 65, I think, that kind of knocks on for our international football in the future.
Yeah, so that Spanish game was certainly very controversial. I mean, I know Eamon Dunphy is very sore about it as well. We drew Spain again in the qualifiers for the 1968 European Championship. And I wouldn't say a forgotten win, but certainly a very famous win. We weren't in contention. We were drawn with Spain and Czechoslovakia. But we went to Prague in 1967, long out of contention, beaten home and away. Beaten in Dublin by the Czechs, beaten home and away by Spain. But all the Czechs had to do was to beat us, I think beat us or draw with us in Prague to qualify for the next phase. And we weren't given much hope. But an incredible, a young Turok O'Connor, making his, I presume it was his international debut, if I remember correctly, scored a sensational winner a few minutes from time. And it was a very, very rare competitive win in continental Europe. And we beat the Czechs 2-1, and that actually sent Spain through. And there is another record of the Spanish sending a crate of their finest wine, as a thank you to Dublin. But I think Eamon Dunphy, if I remember correctly, is claiming the players never saw any of that. But anyway, we'll leave that for... There's certainly a record of it being received by the FAI and the Spanish being very thankful for a shock Irish win that knocked the Czechs out and sent the Spanish through in 68. So, and we didn't win again, actually, in a competitive game. We didn't, sorry, when I say win again, if you want to, obviously we beat some of the smaller teams, but a team, to beat a team of that caliber on continental Europe, I think you're getting up to the win over Austria under Martin O'Neill in 2016. I know we beat the likes of Lithuania, Latvia, Andorra and all them, but I think you're up there on continental Europe probably with that win for Martin O'Neill and that James McLean goal in Vienna, that night in Vienna. So 67 to 2016 is certainly a long time. Mm-hmm. We did have the famous win at Hampden Park in 1987. But that win in Prague also, I suppose, it bookended one of the worst periods of Irish football. I mean, it was a fantastic win. But it started a five-year period when we didn't win a match. So from that win in Prague until 1972, we didn't win a single game. Oof. Friendly, competitive, anything. And certainly some of the dark days of Irish football were from 67 to 72 on the pitch.
Was there a particular reason for that in terms of quality of players or just performances just weren't good enough? Or do we know why? That's a long time.
It's a long time. I mean, we didn't play as many matches in those days as we do today. But even still, I mean, we were in a group for the 1970 World Cup. We got Czechoslovakia again, actually. We had Denmark and Hungary. I mean, we would have been expected to beat Denmark. They were still an amateur team at that stage. They beat us in Copenhagen. The game in Dublin was abandoned, and I think it was replayed again. I think we drew that game. But, I mean, we played the likes of Poland. Of course, we played Poland a couple of times. We did get a couple of draws. The qualifiers for 1972, we ended up drawing Italy, Austria, Sweden, if I remember correctly, were in the group as well. And we took some hammerings as well. I mean, we sent a team to Linz in Austria in 1971, and it was Paddy Mulligan and 10 League of Ireland players. And unfortunately, they were beaten 6-0. Couldn't get some players released from English clubs. Italy beat us comfortably in Dublin and in Florence. And so we went through from 67, 68, 69, 70, lost to Germany in Berlin. 71, as I said, those results. And 72, there was definitely an upturn in 1972. So we were drawn for the 74 World Cup. We were drawn in a group with France and the Soviet Union. And we also went on a tour of Brazil. So in 1972, Brazil organized this huge football tournament to celebrate, I think it was 150 years of independence at the time. Could be wrong on the 1972. When did Brazil get it? I think it was 150 years. Certainly it was a centenary of Brazilian independence of some sort, or a celebration. And we played in the tournament, and we played actually up in the northeast in Recife and in Natal. And we finally got a win. We beat Iran in that tournament. We also beat Ecuador, but Iran was our first win for 5 years. And we also beat Ecuador, lost narrowly to Portugal, and lost to Chile, I think, as well. So we did get knocked out in the group stages. We didn't get to play Brazil. But it was it must have been an incredible trip in 1972 to go to that tournament in Brazil. And we did get much needed wins. And following on from that, we had a very impressive win over France. I'm pretty sure that was in Dalymount Park. And we actually went to Paris the following year and drew 1-1. So some very impressive results against France. The Soviets proved too good for us and they won the group. But I think to beat France at home and draw away was signs of improvement, players starting to come through. And so there was definitely hope for the future. And I'm right up now to 74 and that game. So the first game, I think it was our first game in qualifying for Euro 76, was the Soviet Union, again in Dalymount Park. And Liam Brady made his debut. Johnny Giles was player manager. And it was one of the all-time famous great wins. And it wasn't even on TV. I remember listening to that game on the radio and leaping around the kitchen. I mean, RT in those days just were not interested in Irish football. Some would say nothing has changed. But anyway, it's it was the sport in those days in the 70s was either GAA or horse racing and RT. So the game wasn't live on TV. We won 3-0. Don Givens hit an incredible hat-trick. I can still remember Philip Green on the radio and what a commentator he was. And that was that win in 74 set up probably one of the ones that one of the campaigns that got away. It was an incredible win. We drew and drew away to Turkey around the same time, beat the Swiss at home the following May 75, and we looked in really good shape to qualify for at least for the last eight of Euro 76. Again, it would have been a knockout round before reaching the last four. And unfortunately, in 75, we had an end-of-season trip to play Switzerland and play the Soviets, play the Soviet Union in Kiev. Now, we lost that game narrowly, which was a bit disappointing, but we could have recovered from that. If we had we would have been expecting to beat Switzerland. And unfortunately, we lost 1-0. And maybe the players at the end of the season or maybe the long trip to Kiev took its toll. And that result ultimately cost us a chance to top the group.
That phrase, I think, just haunts Irish football for decades and decades. Expected to win. And then it just all it all seems to fly apart and go out the window. Am I right in saying as well, in that period, did we stop? Did we create the position of a permanent Irish international football manager, and did we go from like a panel that would pick players to a single position managerial position?
Yeah, so that's probably correct. So we had kind of a trainer. We can go right back to Charlie Harris in 1924 to Val Harris. So we had Johnny Carey was the would have been the coach or manager. But the team was picked by selectors. So I think in Mick Meagan in 1970 became the first manager as such. And obviously replaced by the likes of Liam Toohey and then later Johnny Giles became player manager. And so at that stage we had proper manager who picked the team as opposed to a bunch of selectors who, well, in many cases may not have known too much about about what they were picking for us.
Interesting. It's interesting that you say that. So how do you have selectors who don't know that much about the people that they're picking? Are they going on like reputation, or how would have that have worked? What was happening?
Yeah, I mean, they would have been involved in football, but it's probably if you're taking it could be some like people like directors or officials. It wouldn't be
like this. Are you kind of saying unfair. That they wouldn't have been directly involved in, like, would say this wouldn't be a panel of other managers from the League of Ireland or anything like that?
No. So, I mean, it would have been, let's say, in the late 40s and the 50s, the Cunningham family ran Shamrock Rovers, and they would have had a huge influence in the team that would have been selected. So, but they would have been the directors of the club. So, I don't want to name names now, but if you're picking the chairman of Shelburne, the chairman of Shamrock Rovers, the chairman of Galway United, the chairman of Waterford, and they're suddenly coming together to pick the team, And there's certainly stories of bias, and there's question marks over some of the teams that were picked. Mm. And I don't want to be knocking people who got international caps or anything like that.
I just wanted to kind of see where the differentiation kind of was. So now you've got this kind of focal point of a manager who's in charge of everything, picking the team, training sessions, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, they would still have handed a team over to someone like Johnny Carey and said, right, that's the team we've picked for you. I don't know, someone like Johnny Carey, who would have had, obviously, a legend of Irish football, he may well have had some influence. I mean, there's different tales of how much influence the trainer or coach would have had. Mm. But in many cases, they were just told, there's your 11 players and do what you will with them. You
know? Go make it work.
Yeah. But I mean, there are some very famous names were dropped out of Irish teams. And I mean, the likes of Tommy Eglinton was dropped. And I mean, there were some mystifying selections. I'll just put it like that. But certainly from 1970 on, we had a manager who was able to pick his own team. And, now we had situations where sometimes we couldn't get players released. I mentioned that 6-0 defeat in Linz when you had Paddy Mulligan and 10 League of Ireland players on the pitch. And fortunately, we were well beaten that day. There's actually footage of that game on YouTube if anyone wants to Google it.
Oh, very interesting. And because I wanted to ask you about that as well, because where are we in terms of the players and where they're playing now? Is it almost all of them are in England or Scotland, etc., plying their trade, and the influence, I suppose, of the League of Ireland of players within the national team is kind of diminished quite a bit?
So it did vary. I mean, there were if you go into the early 70s, you had the likes of Alfie Nuken got 11 caps at Limerick for Ireland, Tommy McConville, Mick Leach, John Herrick, who only passed away there recently. I mean, they were some of the great League of Ireland players.
Yeah, outstanding players.
All-star earned. And they earned their caps. I mean, Kevin Fitzpatrick played in 69 in Prague. I will have to mention the Limerick bias, of course. But but there were quite a few League of Ireland players would have had. So some of them, we went to Brazil in 72. We went to Brazil again in 74, actually. But it's not just Brazil. We went to the South American tour in 74 with Brazil, Chile, Uruguay. I can't recall exactly who we played in that tour now. So there would have been some League of Ireland players. But the bulk of the team for the big games against the Soviets, against the Swiss in 75, they would mainly be playing cross-channel. So you would have the likes of Johnny Giles at Leeds United, Liam Brady at Arsenal, Gerry Daly, I think he would still have been at Man United in those days, played for Derby County as well, of course. Terry Mancini at Queen's Park Rangers, Paddy Mulligan at Chelsea, Crystal Palace, etc. Mick Martin, Don Givens up front at QPR. I mean, QPR finished runners-up in the top flight in 1976. Mm. And that was a really talented QPR side with a huge Irish support in London in those days. It still has a huge Irish support in London, but particularly in 1976 when they very, very nearly won the league. And they'd finished the season on top of the league, but Liverpool had a game in hand and they won with late goals against Wolves, if I remember rightly. But so we had players playing at the top level in England in those days in the 70s, and they would have been household names in English football. I should also mention in 1973 a great win over Poland, and Maya Dennehy, he was a son of the League of Ireland, but he was already at Nottingham Forest at this stage. But in 1973. Poland famously knocked England out of the World Cup at Wembley. And Jan Tomaszewski, the goalkeeper, who I think was Brian Clough had called the clown,
that's right,
produced the game of his produced the game of his life, and Poland drew 1-1 and qualified for the 74 World Cup, where, of course, they finished third. I think they finished third. Anyway, 4 days later, they came to Dublin to Daly Mount Park, and they weren't able to hold Ireland to a draw because we beat them 1-0 thanks to Maya Dennehy, another famous name in Cork football. I have to mention that he was a very proud son of Cork. Famous for getting the hat-trick in the 1972 FAI Cup final when Hibs beat Waterford. But I'm pretty sure Maya was already at Nottingham Forest in those days. But he got the winner, and that win over Poland in 1973 is, again, one of the famous wins and one of the signs that Irish football was coming out of the dark days from 67 to 72. Win over France in 72, the win over Poland in 73, beating the Soviets in Daly Mount in 74, even beating the Swiss in 75. They were incredible wins. The draw I mentioned in Paris in 73. Some impressive performances home and away. And the likes of Liam Brady coming through, Paddy Mulligan, Johnny Giles still able to do it, obviously. Don Givens scoring the goals up front, Gerry Daly, Mick Cairns in goal. There was a decent side there.
Was that the kind of turning point where it's, you kind of mentioned that turning point where we begin to kind of win games and stuff like that. Is the turning point kind of a new generation of players that are coming through, or is it we're learning to play football maybe in a different way than we've done before? What kind of, is there something where you can kind of put your finger on where it begins to change, where we kind of...
I was very young watching those teams as well. So I think it is a combination. I mean, certainly Johnny Giles, as player manager, introduced maybe a level of professionalism. And certainly some of the players coming through did become household names. They did make a difference. I mean, Don Givens went on to be our all-time leading goal scorer. Obviously, the record's long gone. But... there were some key players there that made a difference. The level of professionalism, certainly under Johnny Giles, went up a notch. I mean, you go back into the 50s and 60s, we played games on Sundays and players played for their clubs on the Saturday, you know, in England, and came over in the boat without a lot of sleep on Saturday night. You know, so there were certainly levels of professionalism went up a few notches in the 1970s, and I'm sure that did make a difference. Johnny Giles was a brilliant player, and he was a great manager as well. Player manager, managed West Brom, managed Shamrock Rovers, and probably introduced a level of professionalism into the League of Ireland when he came in 1977 as player manager of Shamrock Rovers. And brought him in Dunphy, and Ray Tracy was on that team as well. So.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Really fantastic stuff. So I suppose to sum up, I suppose where we are, we've gone from like the late 50s to, we'll say, the early 70s-ish with the national team. How would you describe that period? Because it kind of goes from the darkness, I suppose, to some good times eventually.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't forget the good times in the early 60s either. I mean, we did come and we had some impressive wins in the late 50s. I talked about that win over Sweden and obviously Fionnuala Fáil in Dusseldorf, but we get to the last eight of the Euros in 64. But losing out in the 66 World Cup probably took its toll. We had some dark days from 67 to 72. There's no doubt about that. And... those heavy defeats, well beaten by Italy in Florence, hammered in Linz by the Austrians. But then things definitely improved around 72. We said the win over France, the win over Poland, the win over the Soviets, even the win over the Swiss in 75. There were definitely signs of better days to come. And 76 Euros is possibly one that got away, given how well we did to beat the Soviets in Dublin, beating the Swiss at home. We ended up hammering Turkey. Don Gibbon scored. He got a hat-trick against the Soviets. He got four against Turkey in 75 as well, but ultimately fruitless campaign. We were starting to believe we could qualify for tournaments. And obviously it's one for another podcast, but we can go on into the late 70s and early 80s when there's a few hard luck stories in the Nearly Men as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But it puts us on the road to what you'd probably arguably call the golden generation of what was to come in the late 80s as well, though, wouldn't it?
Well, after the way that has to be the golden generation, the late 80s, early 90s. And I don't think there's any argument over that.
That's about five podcasts worth of stuff in there. Gary, as ever, thank you very much for joining us. Always fascinating, always good to chat about some of the great stuff that we have in our national game that perhaps often gets overlooked as well, which is really great. So until next time, Gary Spain, thank you very much.
Here, thanks.
Well, that's it for this week's show. You can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music, or YouTube Podcast, and more. You can find us there. Share the show on your social media as well to help us spread the word about the podcast. And go support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League clubs. It's our heritage. It's our game. Until next time, bye for now.